Do you mind if I sign in here?
Oh, go ahead. Mr. Sobey, do you wish any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Michael Sobey. I'm here on behalf of Damian Spencer. The reason we're here today is because the Circuit Court of Wythe County, the Honorable Judge Josiah Showalter presiding, abused his discretion in denying Mr. Spencer a motion to withdraw his plea of no contest to certain charges that were present before the court that day. And this is an abuse of discretion standard. But the case law that has preceded us here today has given a great deal of guidance to all of us in the bar as to what constitutes an abuse of discretion in this, because the case law, going back to as far as Parrish and Justice and all, and Bottoms even, in the cases, and most recently the Hernandez case, speak in language that's as close to mandatory as you can get for these types of cases without being mandatory, where it says that the motion should not be denied, it should be granted. And the word should is used many times in these cases, and it should not be denied where it is the least evident that the ends of justice will be served. And the cases then follow along with certain elements, if you will, that must be met to show that the motion is not that the end of justice will be served. Timeliness, that's not an issue in this case. There's no question that the motion was made timely. It was before trial. There's no question, no issue of prejudice to the Commonwealth in this case. There was a vague reference to it at the motions hearing because they want finality for the victim. Well, we want finality for everybody in every case, but the cases that have followed along say prejudice would be more defined as what did the Commonwealth give up in terms of something. There was no plea agreement in this case. There was no sentencing agreement. Everything was tried to the court. So the Commonwealth didn't lose. The Commonwealth is not prejudiced. The Commonwealth did not already partially perform a plea agreement of any sort. So the real issue then comes down to the final one, which is, was it made in good faith?
And there's also a requirement that the defendant has a reasonable basis for contesting his guilt.
That is summed up, that is part of the good faith part of it, which is what I believe, and that is. And in this case, the reason for contesting his guilt was after it was discovered later that the search warrant that initiated this entire process was not valid. It was not for anything that belonged to the defendant.
Was any affirmative evidence of that put on at the hearing?
There was a proffer made at that which was uncontested. At the
agreed proffer by the Commonwealth? It was not, wasn't it?
The Commonwealth did not contest my proffer at that, and the proffer is used routinely throughout these, and even in Hernandez, where it says the Supreme Court of Virginia has determined that the standard for withdrawing such pleas requires the defendant to, one, establish a good faith basis for making the guilty plea and later seeking to withdraw it, and two, to proffer evidence of a reasonable basis for contesting guilt. The only thing that the Commonwealth did regarding my proffer saying that search warrant was invalid was say, well, even if it was, we still had other evidence. Well,
all the but you didn't present any affirmative evidence in terms of the actual phone number, the actual search warrant, the affidavit, anything along those lines.
And there's nothing that I see that requires that to happen other than proffer. It's just, you see words like proffer, prima facie, the evidence itself.
But getting to the issue of good faith, to follow up on Judge O'Brien's question, how is a court supposed to determine good faith if, you know, your argument is, well, it was in his cell phone number, it was this cell phone number, you know, 12345, as opposed to 23456 number.
Well, the answer to that was the Commonwealth's reaction when they didn't say, yes, he's wrong. Okay? The Commonwealth did not dispute that evidence was wrong.
I looked for the search warrant, and I looked for just something to indicate what was the problem in the record.
It was never placed in the record.
And isn't that the problem? And the reason that you gave at trial is a very conclusory statement. It's just that they did not have a search warrant for a cell phone. Well, maybe they didn't need a search warrant for a cell phone. I mean, there's nothing we can look to in the record and say, you know, this really is an issue that that provides a potential defense.
Well, that then goes to the effectiveness of the defense, not to the underlying good faith that's involved in this. And Hernandez addresses that specifically, where it says that we don't look to see whether or not that specific defense will work. Prima facie, is it a reasonable defense? Is it a defense that is recognized at law? We don't examine whether or not it will succeed.
There wasn't it an insanity defense, right? In Hernandez.
Hernandez was an insanity defense, and that's the conclusion that's what Judge Showalter tried to base it on.
Motion to suppress, which could be knock out a lot of evidence, or it could be just largely just a strategic move that would knock out nothing.
That analysis is not part of what the trial court should be doing. What the trial court should be doing is saying...
Does that go to whether there's a reasonable defense, whether there's a useful or useless motion to suppress?
No, I don't think it makes any significant difference, but what does make a difference in here is that the trial court never made any kind of finding of fact or finding as a matter of law that it was unreasonable. And that is something also that Hernandez says, and I think it's an important one, in reading from Hernandez here, in a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, it is not the trial court's role to evaluate credibility of witness, nor to determine whether the proffered defense will be successful. The role of the trial court is to determine whether the defendant has made a prima facie showing of a reasonable defense. If the trial court finds as a matter of law that the defendant has no reasonable defense, it may then deny the motion. I think a logical reading following onto that, if the court does not make such a finding, it may not deny the motion. And this court made no such finding. As a matter of fact, the only thing this court did was do everything that Hubbard said he couldn't do. Now, the Hubbard case says can't rely. It's a misplaced reliance on the colloquy. And that's all Judge Showalter relied on was the colloquy. And in terms of the defense that I proffered as to the inadmissibility of all the evidence, and I did use the term all the evidence in this, is to say, you're asking me to speculate. Well, I specifically said you can't speculate, Judge. And it's on page 18 of the transcript even where I told him, you can't speculate, you can't evaluate. All you can do is determine what, and he made no such finding. That in its of itself constitutes an abuse of discretion.
How do you distinguish the Supreme Court's opinion in Edmonds?
Edmonds, I'm going to tell you. Edmonds, he was showing, that was the defense of duress, I believe, in that particular case. And there was nothing to suggest that there was no proffer even made of any evidence to show that there was a duress. Here, I did make a proffer of evidence, a proffer of the basis for it. And again, it was a proffer that was unrefuted. Now, the Commonwealth, in its reply reply brief, said that it was refuted. The Commonwealth did contest that proffer. No, the only reference that is being made to is, again, going back to the plea colloquy, which court's already said you can't rely. It's a misplaced reliance on anything that happened in the plea colloquy. So that defense, again, nothing was put forward, and the court was able to make a finding. The court did make a finding in that case as a matter of law. There's no such finding in this case. Actually, I think covered pretty much what I wanted to get to on that one. The cases that say that have upheld the trial courts and that all have those findings in them. There is a finding somewhere. The only thing that this court did, the only finding this court made was I have a really good plea colloquy and I use it a lot and it covers everything. And then said, I'm not going to speculate. Well, I told him don't speculate. But he did not make any findings. He didn't make any findings as to timeliness. He didn't make any findings as to prejudice. He didn't make any findings as to good faith. He didn't make any findings as to the reasonableness of the defense. And I say it's a fair reading of Hernandez to say if he makes a finding, he may deny. If he doesn't make that finding, he may not deny. Thank you.
All right. You have time remaining for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Fitzgerald.
Still morning, I think. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. agree that we are dealing with a lower standard here when the defendant moves to set aside his guilty plea prior to sentencing. However, this court held in Coleman that the trial court does not need to automatically grant such motions. The defendant still has the burden to show under both halves of that Paris test that his motion to withdraw the guilty plea is being made in good faith and that he has a substantial basis for contesting guilt.
Do you agree that there is an unavowed proffer of what the basis for the plea is by the defendant?
The basis for the suppression?
Yes, the discussion about the motion to suppress.
Two responses, Your Honor. First, I don't think that it's uncontested because in the Commonwealth stipulation of facts, that it was read during the plea colloquy, but we're talking about the factual stipulation on appendix page 24 and 25 that the Commonwealth read. It said that the phone was searched pursuant to a search warrant. That stipulation was agreed to by the defendant and defense counsel separately. And so that factual stipulation is separate from the standard plea colloquy questions, is your plea voluntary, have you talked to counsel, et cetera. And I think that kind of distinction was played out by the court a little bit. I believe it's Pritchard, where the court held in the context of a Rule 3 plea agreement. Those kind of representations are separate from the kind of representations that the court deals with.
If there was a disagreement as to whether the basis for the request was sufficient, is an appellant right that requires a finding by the trial court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, does the trial court have to break that tie, if you will, and say, well, I think that there has been sufficient proffer, or I think that the Commonwealth's denial is what I'm going to base my ruling on? It has to make an affirmative finding.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there needs to be an affirmative finding. In this case, at this level, the trial court is presumed to know and follow the law. The trial court was given Hernandez and, in fact, took a recess a significant number of days to research that issue and came back and said that this was not the kind of defense that was contemplated in Hernandez. And I would also note this court has rejected argument of counsel as constituting a proffer in the Ramsey case. Counsel there said, my client has an alibi witness and I have other witnesses that I believe would substantiate that. And this court found that that kind of statement, not backed up by affidavits, not backed up by testimony, was not a substantial or a sufficient proffer. Again, in Ramsey and in Williams, the proffer has to be sustained by proofs, and that's what's missing in this case. We do not have a defense that is sustained by proofs. As the court noted, we don't.
So a proffer for purposes of withdrawing a guilty plea is different than, say, a proffer of what a witness would testify to at trial?
Your Honor, I believe the case law in this area bears that out, specifically in Ramsey, but also in Coleman. In Coleman, where the defense pled that this was going to be a mistaken ID defense. So my client's going to go to trial and say that, it wasn't me. And in that circumstance, there was no evidence that any of these witnesses were confused. There was no evidence that anyone had actually, committed a mistake in the identification there because there was no proof that defense is not sustained by proofs. It was not supported by affidavits, et cetera. It's not a proper proffer. We're talking about proffering evidence here. And in cases where, there wasn't live testimony taken in Justice and Paris, those cases, the defense was proffered by affidavit. And I believe in Justice, the attorney had witnesses there prepared to go forward, and the court elected to take that evidence by affidavit. But what's significant in all of these cases where the Commonwealth prevails on appeal is that we have a lack of proof. In Coleman, in Edmonds, in Ramsey, in Williams are all cases where the court found that the proffered defense simply wasn't substantial enough. It wasn't reasonable enough. And in making that determination, the court can look at, the rest of the record and is this something, is it substantial? Is it reasonable? I'm using the same words again, but that is the test that this court looks to, and distinguishing that from the cases where the defendant has prevailed on appeal, Bottoms, Hernandez.
Can I just interrupt you for 1 second on that? So if it were a motion to suppress, that would appear to knock out a considerable amount of evidence, would that satisfy the reasonable defense? That, that you have a substantive reasonable defense? Or is that just not enough because it's sort of trial strategy?
Sure, Your Honor. So we've also argued on brief that a suppression defense is not the kind of defense that the court was contemplating when we talk about a reasonable basis for contesting guilt. A reasonable basis for contesting guilt, this court and the Virginia Supreme Court cases have pretty uniformly held, and it may be that's just what the cases were that were before them, but the case law deals with a defense that would knock out an element at trial. He didn't have the intent. It wasn't premeditated, et cetera.
What if this were a drug case? The introduction of the drugs is game, set, and match when it comes to obtaining a conviction. And the motion to, or the request to withdraw the guilty plea says, I can show that this evidence was illegally seized and therefore not admissible. Wouldn't that be a basis for withdrawing the guilty plea?
In a case where all we have perhaps are the drugs that come in and the suppression motion will knock out all the evidence, it may be a different case than what we have here. But on this case, this suppression defense...
Well, that leads me to my next question. Now, the Supreme Court has said that the trial court is not supposed to look at the viability of the defense in terms of whether he would ultimately prevail.
Yes, Your Honor. We're not talking about whether the defendant will ultimately prevail. We're talking about whether this is a reasonable defense on the record. And so in making that reasonableness determination, this court and the Supreme Court have looked at the other evidence in the case. In the Williams case, where this was the case with the gentleman who asked the victim if she wanted to use his cell phone, and then ultimately he sexually assaulted her. There, he wanted to get a trial and contest that witness's credibility. He wanted to say he didn't do it. And the court said, no, that's not a reasonable defense because you've already confessed. So the court can look at the other evidence in the record. Also in Coleman, when we're talking about the witness ID, the court said, look, all these witnesses have already identified you. That's not a reasonable defense. So we're not looking at it in a vacuum.
Follow up on Judge Petty's question. My original question is, a motion to suppress could conceivably lead to a reasonable defense.
Yes, I think that's right, Your Honor.
But here your argument is there wasn't enough connected to the motion to suppress.
Correct.
To decide that question.
Correct, Your Honor. In particular, we don't have the warrant. We don't know what the deficiency is. I believe on brief, counsel argued that it was the warrant was for someone else's cell phone or for a friend's cell phone, but not this defendant's cell phone. At trial, all we see in the record is that there's a defect, it was the wrong cell phone. We don't know whether that's numbers being transposed, whether that cell phone belongs to this guy's father and not him. We just don't know what kind of defect.
Mr. Sobey's point, though, is, well, the Commonwealth didn't object. The Commonwealth didn't say that was, didn't contest the fact that it was someone else's cell phone that the search warrant was for.
Well, I still think that the trial court, on the strength of that essentially argument from counsel, could find that that's not the kind of substantial defense supported by proofs that would be necessary to withdraw his plea at this stage. Having not seen the search warrant, and of course it's not in the record, it's not before this court either, we just can't know whether that's a substantial defense or whether that's a formal defense.
Wouldn't you agree that there's a bit of tension between the Supreme Court cases on this issue and cases coming out of our court? The Supreme Court seems to be saying pretty clearly that, well, any reason, even if it was just entered inadvisedly, if a reasonable ground is offered for going to the jury, he should withdraw his plea, or any defense at all should be sufficient grounds for permitting a change of plea from guilty to not guilty. But our cases seem to be a little more strict in demanding a higher degree of proof than any reason.
Well, I don't think that there's a... I guess I disagree that the Supreme Court has required less, because the cases that court has taken up and have ruled on have all involved higher levels of proof. They've all involved additional testimony. They've all involved proffers. They've all involved affidavits. And we don't have a situation where the Supreme Court is accepting, argument of counsel to stand in place of a defense. All of the Supreme Court cases have a substantial basis for us to reach this issue. And in the Paris case, you know, in subsequent cases, they do go on to say that it has to be, you still have to prove that it's a substantial defense, a reason for contesting guilt, a reason to go to the jury. And I guess that goes back to Judge Bill's your question, is a suppression defense a defense that you would take to a jury? It's not a trial defense. You have to have a reason for going to trial. And the defendant in this case has made no statement that he wants to go to trial on this defense. In fact, suppression is a pretrial remedy. And this defendant doesn't have a reason to go to trial. And that's what the Supreme Court has required in talking about, you know, injustice and absolute defense to these charges where someone can't break into their own home. Or in Paris, when if the defendant had married the prosecutrix, there wouldn't be a defense. And I think that those kind of defenses are just, you know, substantially different, for lack of a better word.
But you told me earlier that in the case of a drug offense, if you could establish that the search was unconstitutional, that would permit the withdrawal of a guilty plea.
I did say that in an effort to be reasonable, because I think it's a harder case. In that case, I think the Commonwealth is in a harder position to say, you know, that's not a reasonable basis, and all the evidence is gone. You know, maybe if we want to draw that fine legal distinction, I would certainly argue that it's not. But I think, you know, I don't have to be in that.
But again, that would require the trial court to inquire into the validity of the motion or the chance of success at trial.
So in order to plead a prima facie case, a prima facie defense, you need to put on evidence to do that. And there's a difference between determining credibility and determining success of a defense. You know, what the court did in Hernandez, where they had two expert witnesses testifying, and the court said, yes, you're more credible than the other witness, so I'm not going to let this go to trial. And, you know, that's a credibility determination. That is talking about the success of a case. But the defendant still has to make a prima facie case. And saying, without even showing the warrant in this case, you know, that a suppression motion is a valid defense is simply not going to make it under the Paris standard and under this court's case law and other circumstances. Saying the magic words, you know, I want to challenge the witness's identification of me. I want to raise a suppression motion. I have an alibi. None of those statements, unsupported by facts, have been sufficient in this court. Well, the suppression one is this case, obviously, but you know, the misidentification issue, the alibi issue, I think they're all very similar in what was in the record in those cases. And you haven't made your prima facie case if what we're talking about is not supported by the record. And that's where we are in this case. And I think the kind of dearth of information that we have here also goes to the good faith aspect of the Paris test. You know, the defendant here hasn't shown why he chose to come back and bring this motion at this time. Again, counsel says, I think he wasn't previously advised of it, but we don't have any testimony from the defendant. We don't have any testimony from prior trial counsel. And again, that is something that is present in this court's case law, you know, where defense counsel in Hernandez takes the stand and says, I misunderstood. I thought this wasn't a valid basis. I didn't advise him of it. Or in Hubbard, which is the case where the gentleman left a note in the Dairy Queen regarding his deceased wife, the defendant takes the stand and says, I felt pressured. I didn't mean to. I didn't want to. And so again, in this case, we don't have any kind of evidence in the record to support why that happened. And there are two prongs of that test, and they are both important, as this court recognized in Pritchard. And here, again, I think the slim record before this court makes it difficult for the defendant to prove his case in this regard. And I would note this court held in Coleman and the other cases on, you know, the abuse of discretion bear this out. But this court should not reverse the trial court unless there is clear evidence in the record that the trial court abused its discretion. And certainly on this slim record, we do not have clear evidence that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the defendant's motion. And I apologize, I don't have time, Judge Petty, but...
You're right on time.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Ms.
Well, I'm happy to answer questions, but it appears that I'm done. I'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
I'm going to address a couple of issues here. First, the issue regarding the alleged stipulation to the agreed facts that was in the plea colloquy. First, I say it doesn't matter because that was all part of the plea colloquy, and it's a misplaced reliance on that. But even towards that, there was no written stipulation of facts here, as there was in, say, I think it was the Ramsey case, which had that, where the parties did agree to a stipulation of facts. There was none here. The only question was asked after the plea colloquy and the the facts as proffered by the Commonwealth, the court. All right, thank you. Mr. Scott and Mr. Spencer, would you agree that that would be the Commonwealth's evidence in these cases? Not agree that that was the accurate or true evidence, but that would be the Commonwealth's evidence in these cases. And that's on the transcript of page 14. And a big difference between this case and the other ones that counsel has cited, where new witnesses have come forward, that testimony, it wasn't just being proffered, that affidavits were being, this is not something, this is a piece of paper that is going to speak for itself in front of the judge when we put it back up there. And the defense, the judge made no ruling as to the defense. He made no finding, and that's the big difference here. There has to be a finding as to that. And what this court has said is that it's a defense that is recognized by law that is not merely formal or dilatory, and there's nothing merely formal or dilatory about the Bill of Rights. Absolutely, there's nothing merely formal about that. Okay? And as a reason to go to trial, I'll take a case to trial any day that has no evidence, period. I've done it. And I'll take a case to trial any day that the evidence, as the court's point, drug cases are a classic example of that. And even the statement of facts that the Commonwealth has submitted in part of their brief on this shows that search warrant came first and everything followed. And it will all be fruit of the poisonous tree. Okay.
Let me stop you now, because I'm not sure I agree with that. Just because it followed the search warrant, wouldn't you agree that does not necessarily make
Not necessarily, but see, the facts of this case that are irrelevant to the proceedings that we have and were irrelevant to what was before the trial court will show that it was.
I'm not sure from the stipulation of facts that I could conclude that, for instance, his admission was necessarily a fruit of the poisonous tree.
Well, that's something for me to prove to the trial court when we get back, okay, which I'm perfectly willing to do. And as for proffers, this court accepts proffers of evidence all the time, not merely just testimonial. And although it's an unpublished case, and some of this came out of this court April 11th of this year, Langen versus Commonwealth, where the court held that the circuit court abused its discretion in revoking appellate's suspended sentence because there was insufficient evidence in the record as to whether he had unreasonably failed to pay restitution. In that case, appellant's counsel proffered that the appellant had not violated the terms of her suspended sentence, and this court overturned that because the statement was not rebutted by the evidence. There's no evidence rebutting my statement that that search warrant was invalid, my proffer that that search warrant was invalid. The Commonwealth didn't address it at all, only to the extent to say, well, even if it was, we have other stuff. So this case does need to be overturned, Your Honor, and I'm not asking for anything other than a fair trial for my client. That's all we're asking for. We're not saying dismiss, send it back, and let justice be served with a full and fair trial in the circuit court.
All right. Thank you very much.